Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 2nd of September, these are our main stories. Two more members of the far-right Proud Boys group get long sentences for the Capitol Hill riot in the US in 2021. Tens of millions in Hong Kong and areas of mainland China take shelter against a super typhoon. And Mohammed Al-Fayed, the Egyptian businessman who owned Harrods in London, has died. Also in this podcast, Christie's cancels sales of jewellery from the widow of a German billionaire who made his fortune during the Nazi era. And in Mexico, goodness gracious, great balls of cheese.
For us and for our cattle producers in this region, it is going to be a part of history to have the biggest piece of cheese in the world.
Now, staunch supporters of Donald Trump, the far-right group known as the Proud Boys, were among the first to storm the US Capitol just after the 2020 election. Three of its members have already been given long prison sentences for their involvement. A fourth Proud Boy has just been jailed for 18 years, the longest sentence yet. Our North America editor Sarah Smith is in Washington.
There's probably about 300 Proud Boys. They're marching.
Thousands of people marched on the Capitol on the 6th of January 2021. The violence that followed has already led to hundreds of convictions, with the longest sentences going to the people who organised and coordinated the riot. The neo-fascist Proud Boys saw themselves as Donald Trump's foot soldiers, prepared to use force to stop Joe Biden being certified as president. Ethan Nordine and Joseph Biggs took charge of the Proud Boys on that day, using a radio to coordinate and move their men. They've both been convicted of seditious conspiracy.
We know what the oath is. Support.
Nordine has received one of the longest sentences related to the January 6th riots, 18 years in prison.
We love Trump! We love Trump!
Donald Trump had invited his supporters to come to Washington and to march towards Congress, using language many believed encouraged the violence that followed.
We fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
Joseph Biggs sobbed in court and begged for leniency before he was sentenced to 17 years in jail. His lawyer blames the former president.
Where's Donald Trump in all of this? He stood on the ellipse, basically told people, 74 million of his followers, the election's stolen, go to the Capitol, fight like hell or you won't have a country anymore. Some people listen to him.
Dominic Pozzola can be clearly seen smashing a window in Congress, which then ignited the invasion of the building. He's been sentenced to 10 years in prison. In a debate with Joe Biden before the 2020 election, Donald Trump refused to condemn racist violence and name-checked the Proud Boys.
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
The Proud Boys leader, Enrique Tarrio, will be sentenced next week. Donald Trump himself is facing a criminal trial next year over his actions to try to overturn the 2020 election result. If he's convicted, he also could be facing a lengthy jail sentence.
Sarah Smith in Washington. Hong Kong has issued its highest storm alert for Super Typhoon Saola. The authorities are warning it could be the strongest storm to hit the area in decades, with winds of up to 175 kilometres an hour. Hundreds of flights have been cancelled and schools, businesses and financial markets have been closed. In the neighbouring Chinese province of Guangdong, nearly 800,000 people have been moved from high-risk areas. Earlier, streets in Hong Kong were deserted. So how prepared are people across the region for Typhoon Saola in Hong Kong for us? Here's Martin Yip.
The buildings are shaking, but there's also something that is less of a concern for Hong Kong during a typhoon season. It's usually about debris flying around. This time we haven't received any reports of that kind, so it might be the upside of the whole situation at the moment.
And how do the people you've been talking to caught up in this, how do they feel about it? Are they scared?
Yeah, they do feel scared because of buildings shaking. And of course, this wind speed is pretty amazing, so anything flies around that's obviously going to be trouble. And also heavy rainfalls are expected, but that's more or less things that people get used to. It seems this quasi-lockdown situation will have to continue all the way till tomorrow morning and possibly by lunchtime. And one indicator is from Cathay Pacific, Hong Kong's major airlines. They are expecting to resume outgoing flights from Hong Kong from midday. So that might give some hints that until tomorrow afternoon, we might still have to weather this kind of storm. So the best advice the government has always been giving is to stay home, stay away from windy locations, stay away from the glasses.
Martin Yip in Hong Kong. Now, also following Typhoon Saola is BBC Weather's Stav Danaos.
It's taken an unusual path. It's not making a direct landfall. It hurtled in from the east off the South China Sea. And instead of barreling inland and weakening as it moves inland, it's actually turned a corner, moving southwestward. So the actual eye is travelling along the coastline with the outer edges affecting Hong Kong and the south coast of Guangdong province. And it's going to continue to move parallel to the coast, weakening as it does so, pushing southwestwards through tonight and into Saturday morning, heading down towards the Lushan Peninsula and Hainan Island by the time we reach next Monday and Tuesday. However, it's still bringing some really heavy rainfall across the coast of southern Guangdong, including Hong Kong.
Well, I mean, they do get typhoons in Hong Kong, but this one seems to be particularly strong.
Yeah, it has been a while since the Hong Kong area has seen a powerful typhoon like this almost make landfall there. But other parts of Guangdong are seeing the impacts from the heavy rain, the strong winds at the moment.
And there's a different typhoon, another one, approaching Taiwan.
That's right. We've got Typhoon Haikou, which is barreling towards Taiwan. That's continuing to strengthen as well. I don't think it'll reach super typhoon, but close to. And then it's likely to make landfall on Sunday across Taiwan, weakening as it continues through the Taiwan Strait and then into East China by around next Tuesday. So there's a double whammy of typhoon impacts across the south and east coast of China.
Stav Danaos from BBC Weather. The Panama Canal Authority says waiting times for vessels that reach the area without a booking have doubled because of a serious drought in the region. About 120 ships are currently waiting for their turn to cross. Here's our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
Transit has been restricted for months and cargo ships are having to wait on average 9 to 10 days before being allowed to enter the canal. The Panama Canal, which links the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific, uses water from an artificial reservoir, Lake Gatun, to feed a system of locks. In the process, vast amounts of fresh water are lost to the sea. A prolonged drought in Central America has forced the administrators to cut the number of daily crossings by about 10%, which has caused a bottleneck on both ends of the canal. The restrictions are expected to remain in place for at least another 10 months.
The auction house Christie's has said it's cancelling plans to sell more jewels from the estate of the wife of a German billionaire who made his fortune during the Nazi era. Part of Heidi Horton's jewellery collection was auctioned by Christie's in May, raising more than $200 million. Christie said the first sale had provoked intense scrutiny and reaction that deeply affected the auction house and many others. US attorney Stephen Lieberman created a group to oppose the first auction. He told Julian Marshall how Helmut Horton, a former Nazi Party member, acquired his fortune.
Helmut Horton was an Austrian businessman who died a billionaire, and his fortune was based in large part on businesses that he bought during the Aryanization process in Germany and Austria in 1936, 37, and 38. Jewish business owners were required by law to sell their businesses, and Helmut Horton and others like him went to Jewish business owners and made deeply discounted offers, 10%, 20% of the value of businesses. And if people said that the prices weren't fair or they didn't want to sell, Wharton said, fine, we'll use our Gestapo connections, and the Gestapo will be at your front door tomorrow, and you and your family will be taken off to the camps. And it was off the backs of those deeply discounted businesses that Helmut Wharton made his fortune. Wharton, after the war, married Heidi, and Heidi Wharton began to acquire a fabulously expensive collection of jewelry using the fortune that he had made from the businesses stolen from Austrian and from German Jews.
I mean, although they were ill-gotten gains, that jewelry was legally purchased, was it?
The jewelry was legally purchased, but it was purchased with money that had been stolen from Jews, who ultimately, most of whom, were sent off to death camps and murdered by the Nazis.
And that is why you and Jewish groups objected to the first sale by Christie's in May.
That's right. When you hear the name Christie's, you think a reputable organization that cares about its name. But when these issues were brought to Christie's attention, they didn't do anything to stop the auction. They simply said the jewelry was legally purchased. The jewelry itself was not stolen from Jews by the Nazis. They weren't going to halt the auction. They didn't think about the moral issues. And frankly, I don't think they thought about the legal issues, because the jewelry is property that was purchased with money that was made from stealing businesses from Jews, many of whom were murdered. And there may well be claims on that jewelry by the descendants of people who were forced to sell their businesses to Helmut Wharton.
Christie's said that the more than $200 million raised by that first sale would go to philanthropic causes. Has it, do you know?
These were philanthropic causes chosen by Heidi Wharton. They were not philanthropic causes designed to reimburse the people from whom the businesses were stolen. Faced with a very bad publicity, Christie said that some of the money would be donated to Holocaust organizations. That was, I think, quite rightly viewed by Jewish groups as a bribe to shut these groups up.
Nonetheless, you must be satisfied that Christie's has called off plans to sell more jewels from the estate of Heidi Wharton.
We are very pleased, and we ask Christie's to go a step further and to make a public commitment that in the future they will not sell any more jewelry from this collection, and they will not auction off similar property. This is blood jewelry. It would be as if you had somebody who had engaged in the trafficking of children and used the money from the trafficking of children to buy artworks, which then Christie put up for sale. A reputable auction house shouldn't do that, and we call on Christie's to state that it will not engage in such despicable behavior in the future.
U.S. Attorney Steve Lieberman. The Egyptian-born businessman Mohammed Al-Fayed has died. He was 94. The self-made billionaire was the former owner of the famous London department store Harrods and also Fulham Football Club. But an inquiry into Mr. Al-Fayed's business dealings led successive governments to refuse to grant him British citizenship, much to his frustration.
You think this is fair from the Home Secretary to behave the way with someone like me, who have given employment to thousands of people, having four British kids? Just it shows what type of people, you know, infiltrate in the political life and give us such a deal.
Mr. Al-Fayed's death comes 26 years after his son Dodi was killed in a car crash in Paris with Princess Diana, the first wife of King Charles. Our UK correspondent Rob Watson looks back at his life.
Mohammed Fayed began in business selling soft drinks and sewing machines in Egypt. He went on to own the world's most famous department store, amassing fortune and controversy on the way. He built a shipping business from scratch and came to Britain in the 1970s, renaming himself Al-Fayed. To those he clashed with, and there were many, he was an abrasive, obsessive character given to feuding. He bought the Paris Ritz and later the jewel in the retail crown, the Harrods department store in London. His battle with Tiny Rowland, chairman of Lonro, ahead of that takeover, was vitriolic. A British government inquiry later accused him of dishonesty, and he was repeatedly refused a British passport. In the mid-1990s, he revealed he'd paid British Conservative MPs to ask questions in Parliament. That put him at the centre of the crisis over sleaze that eventually felled Prime Minister John Major's government in the 1997 general election. When his son, Dodi Al-Fayed, was killed along with Diana, Princess of Wales, in a car crash in Paris, he claimed it was murder plotted by the Duke of Edinburgh and the British Secret Service. Mohammed Al-Fayed refused to accept that the couple's driver, Henri Paul, an employee of his, had been drunk at the wheel.
Henry Paul was on the payroll of the MI6 for 3 years as an informer. What happened to Diana and what happened to my son is a murder, and I'm not going to keep quiet until I get to the truth.
A French investigation and a British inquest rejected those claims. He gave large sums to charity, but was accused of bullying staff too. He eventually sold Harrods after a row with the pension fund managers over the size of his dividend. He cast himself as the underdog, yet he'd always craved acceptance from the establishment.
Rob Watson on the life of Mohammed Al-Fayed. Still to come in the Global News podcast, a rare Iranian and Israeli collaboration to make a film that's blossomed into something special.
In Israel, that became so extreme, and in Iran too, we are not allowed to talk to each other because we're enemies. That's what they taught us. But we're not. We founded this amazing friendship.
Now, on yesterday's podcast, I asked you to email your little win, the thing that's happened in your life or where you live that's made your week, no matter how small. We're collecting them for next week's edition of the Happy Pod. And I just wanted to say thank you for all the emails so far. Here are just a couple of them. Hannah in Sydney, Australia, says the barista at her local cafe gave her a free coffee. And then the next day, she found a $5 note on the floor, so she got another free coffee. Thank you, Hannah. Carolee emailed from St. Pete in Florida to thank her neighbours for helping to keep her home dry and free from debris during the hurricane conditions this week. I had someone watching over me at a time of pure panic, says Carolee. Of course, we'd like more, so please email me with your little win, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You'll hear more of them in the Happy Pod in this feed every Saturday. Thousands of Syrians have taken to the streets in the northwestern city of Suwayda, protesting against their deteriorating living and economic conditions. These demonstrators chanting, "The people want the downfall of the regime." Lina Sinjab is our Middle East correspondent in Beirut. She's been telling my colleague Luqueza Barak more about what's happening in Suwayda.
They brought back all the demands that many Syrians across the country called for in the early days of the uprising in 2011 when there were peaceful protests, as they are today in Suwayda. This is the second week in a row that protesters took to the streets in Suwayda, and today was quite significant because thousands of them took to the streets. They came from different villages and towns around the province of Suwayda, which is a predominantly Druze city that the regime has always been careful in how to deal with them. So there were violent crackdown on protesters there. And what we've seen this time is that the demand of the protesters is not only criticizing the government, but really targeting President Bashar al-Assad himself, calling on him to leave and tearing out posters of him everywhere in the city. So this is quite significant to see.
What was it about the cost of living that brought people out on the streets?
Well, it was a gradual deterioration of the situation since the days of the war. And then the war stopped, so the war economy stopped, so dollars stopped flowing into the country. The Syrian pound devaluated, cost of living increased. But the worst was the full lift of subsidy on oil in Syria. And that's what flipped the coin for many Syrians, that they cannot afford living anymore. The average wage of a Syrian worker in 2011 was almost $500. Today, it's worth $20. An average family with the $20, they cannot even buy basic food, let alone meat or any other substantial items, just basic foods for 2-3 days. That won't be enough. So people are really starving. The country has more than 90% of the population living under the poverty line. So it's not surprising at all that they would take to the streets.
Where are we seeing these protests? Because they're not in the capital, are they?
That's a very important question. As I mentioned, this is a Druze province that the regime has been very careful in dealing with this minority that is spreading between Syria and Lebanon. For example, Derahan next to it, which is a predominantly Sunni one, which is the birthplace of the uprising, we've seen some protests there, but the reaction from the regime there wouldn't be the same like the reaction to the Druze. It's hard to see the army firing at protesters in Sweda, as they did in many Sunni towns across the country. That's why we're not seeing these kind of protests in any other government-controlled areas, because people are scared. People have been killed, bombed, and detained. And the regime is very careful in how to deal with the Druze. That's why we can see this momentum in Sweda, but it's hard to see it happening somewhere else after more than a decade of civil war, hundreds of thousands killed, millions in refugees, and tens of thousands who've disappeared. So people are really wary on what to do in the streets, although the anger is mounting even among the Alawite community that is the main supporter of President Bashar al-Assad. Last week, the government introduced cuts of income tax, but that's too little, too late for many people. However, given the violent nature of this regime, it's hard to see how long they're going to tolerate this situation there.
Our Middle East correspondent, Lina Sinjab, reporting. An Egyptian government official has submitted his resignation over the destruction of a number of historic mausoleums in centuries-old cemeteries in Cairo. The Egyptian authorities say they're developing and restoring the area, but the campaign has caused considerable anger on social media, with some saying Cairo's architectural heritage is under threat. Here's our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
Dr. Ayman Wanas says he's resigning because his task of logging buildings of historical and architectural value has been rendered futile. The professor of urban design said the government's project in the ancient cemeteries of Cairo risked wasting Egypt's rich and irreplaceable heritage. Several other members of a committee documenting heritage buildings have already resigned. The cemeteries in Cairo have long been renowned for the elaborate decoration and domes of their mausoleums, dating back hundreds of years. The authorities say what's happening is urban development that's necessary to bring Cairo into a new era. Critics call it cultural vandalism.
The death of a mother bear shot near a national park in central Italy, leaving two cubs alone, has drawn condemnation from animal rights groups and politicians. Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard has been telling me more about what happened and why.
This bear, Amarino, that's their nickname for black cherry, basically one of the fruits that it was very fond of. Two things that are important. One, it was extremely well known and well loved in the area. There was a rather endearing video of the bear going through a local town at night only a few days ago with its two cubs and onlookers looking quite amazed at this scene. And also, it was a female of a very rare subspecies, the rarest subspecies of bear in Europe, a thing called a Marsican brown bear, which lives in the Apennines in Abruzzo, this area of central Italy, east of Rome. And on Thursday night, it was shot and killed. The person who did this was a man in his 50s, and he's told the Italian news agency ANSA that he did it out of fear, that it was on his property, and he had shot it, but it hadn't meant to kill it. But sadly, the bear died of very bad injuries, and the cubs escaped into the countryside.
There's been quite a bit of reaction, both locally and on social media.
Absolutely. First of all, on the political level, you've had the Minister of the Environment chip in. You've also had the Governor of Abruzzo say that it's a very serious act against his whole region. It leaves pain and anger, he said. The head of the national park said this type of bear is never aggressive. Everyone loved her and called her a symbol of the park. And the rangers who posted the picture of the dead bear said that it was just not justifiable, that bear Amarena had never created problems for humans, despite having raided agricultural produce and livestock.
Danny Eberhard. Lots of movies claim to be groundbreaking, but Tatami, which premieres at the Venice Film Festival this weekend, does fit the bill. It's a co-production between an Iranian and an Israeli. The film is about a female judo fighter from Iran who has a shot at winning gold at the World Championships, but the Iranian authorities order her not to compete against her next opponent, who's from Israel, leaving her and her coach in an awful dilemma. Here's the moment when commentators notice something's wrong with the Iranian contestant.
Dunbari, her coach, is not out there with her, and, well, I don't know why.
She really needs to compose herself, yeah.
Yeah, her head seems somewhere else, doesn't it? But this is where she's got to dig in.
The co-directors are the Israeli Guy Nativ and the Iranian Zar Amir. First to Guy, Tim Franks asked him what inspired the film.
in the middle of the pandemic, I read an article about an Iranian boxer named Sadaf Kadem. She really wanted to box in Iran, but she couldn't. And she escaped to France, where she became the first Iranian female boxer. And then more female stories about athletes who rebelled against the regime in Iran for freedom sparked in the news. And that brought the idea to make a movie about that, especially when the Israeli athletes and the Iranian athletes are best friends in the competition outside of their homes.
You're Israeli. Was that the reason why you then tried to get in touch with Saar?
Absolutely. And Elham, who wrote the script with me. So I brought a lot of Iranian artists with me to tell this specific story.
And Saar, how long did it take you to decide that this was a project that you'd like to be involved in?
It took me a little bit of time because it can be risky for everyone, even outside of Iran. I think that this global situation of our society and our planet is to rush towards disaster. We don't know how long we will all be able to live, but at least during this time we do something good. I just thought doing this is a feat. It's daring, it's beautiful, because we've never seen it before.
It's being sort of talked about as a first, this collaboration. You live in exile in France yourself. You left Iran some years ago.
In 2008.
But you just said to me that you had to think about it a bit because it's a very risky project, even with you living in exile. Can you tell me why that is?
As an Iranian filmmaker, what is happening in Iran and Israel is almost the same. Political situation, we don't know what risk exactly you take. Not only because I'm afraid of the Iranian government, but the story that we are telling in this movie is exactly what goes on with us, because that government, that power can influence me, can control me sometimes, even from 1,000 kilometers away.
But it also sounds like you both were drawn to the idea of this fact that an Israeli and an Iranian were cooperating. There was a bigger story behind the scenes, Guy.
What our government are preventing us from doing, we achieved. It's kind of sad that we have to get out of our country to Tbilisi, Georgia, to meet each other, to feel like we are sisters and brothers, to understand that we are from the same tribe. In Israel, that became so extreme, and in Iran, too, we are not allowed to talk to each other because we're enemies. That's what they taught us in school. But we're not. We founded this amazing friendship that is for life. We have the same taste, food, movies, music, sport. And we shot this film under the radar with a different name, and we made it. And that's why this collaboration is so important for us. It's kind of crazy that both countries are going through the same process. There's people who are fighting in Israel against the regime by Benjamin Netanyahu. A lot of people are going to the street to demonstrate. I mean, it's kind of crazy that Saar came to Israel to edit the film in time of demonstrations. We were in the same ground to demonstrate the fight for democracy. And the same thing happens in Iran.
I hope this movie, you know, opens another window. We need to change our mindset. We need to change how we see each other. We don't need enemy. And this movie is my first feature as director, co-director. I really love this movie and I'm very proud. And I hope we make them feel good about this friendship.
Israeli Guy Nassif, the Iranian Saar Amir with Tim Franks about the film Tatami. Let's go to the Mexican town of Pijijiapan now. Local people there have been keeping themselves busy with a bit of record breaking. The residents have banded together to, well, band together a giant ball of cheese, weaving together cheese strings to make a ball the size of a refrigerator. Sounds like a story for Stephanie Prentice.
A giant spinning wheel surrounded by 80 determined Mexicans in white overalls, feeding long strings of white cheese into it to form a ball. But this was no normal day playing with a giant ball of cheese, no. These dairy farmers and cheese professionals had a plan to make a ball of cheese so large that they'd break the world record of a 350-kilogram sphere, using quesillo, a mozzarella-like stretchy semi-hard cheese drawn out into long strings.
It is a source of pride for us. We're happy, proud to be here. For us and for our cattle producers in this region, it is going to be a part of history to have the biggest piece of cheese in the world.
Making the biggest piece of cheese in the world wasn't all smooth sailing. At one point, the Kurds nearly had their way, tilting dangerously close to the ground. But the crowd were there to cheer the workers on. And after much cheering and much spinning, a 558-kilogram piece of wound-up cheese was created, smashing the previous record and securing the team's place in the record books and Pihi Hiapan's place on the map.
Stephanie Prentice reporting. Well, I definitely can't beat the Kurds nearly had their way, so that's all from us for now. There will be a new edition of Global News to download later. This one was mixed by Javed Gilani, the producer was Emma Joseph, the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach, thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.